Mit der ING läuft's einfach. Banking, das nebenbei passiert, kein Stress, kein Drama. In der ING-App regelst du deine Karten selbst. Wunschpin, Limits setzen, sperren mit einem Klick, alles direkt von dir gesteuert. Die ING macht Banking easy. Für dich, für dein Leben. Do your thing.
Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App AOK Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App AOK Navida downloaden und loslegen. AOK Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Lisa Irwin? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the disappearance, then offer my analysis. Lisa Irwin was born on November 11, 2010, in a suburb of Kansas City, Missouri. Her father's name was Jeremy Irwin, and her mother's name was Deborah Bradley. Jeremy and Deborah were romantic partners, but not married. In addition to Lisa, the couple had a son together. Deborah also had a son from another relationship. They all lived together as a family in a house in Kansas City. Jeremy worked as an electrician. Now moving to the timeline of the disappearance. On Friday, October 3, 2011, at 2:30 p.m., Jeremy returned home from his job. He spent some time with the three children in the house, Lisa, his son, and Deborah's son. Deborah and her brother, Philip Netz, departed the house at about 4:30 p.m. They went to a supermarket and purchased boxed wine and baby food, a selection which in itself can be thought of as foreshadowing tragedy. I doubt this particular combination of items is a common choice for future winners of the Mother of the Year Award. Deborah and Phil returned to the house at 5 p.m. Jeremy left the house at about 5:30 p.m. to perform some electrical work at a Starbucks. Deborah's brother Philip also left the house around this time. Jeremy did not normally work at night. This was out of the ordinary, but it represented an opportunity to earn extra money. Jeremy thought that he would be home by 10 p.m. Deborah remained at home with the three children. At about 6 p.m., a next-door neighbor named Samantha Brando made her way to the same store where Deborah had purchased alcohol earlier and bought more alcohol. Samantha was planning on spending some time with Deborah that evening. There's a sense that all this alcohol purchasing behavior was not just for the flavor. At about 6:40 p.m., Deborah put Lisa in her crib. This is the last time she would ever see Lisa. Around the same time, Samantha and her four-year-old daughter arrived at the Irwin family house. As Samantha's daughter played with Deborah's two sons, Deborah and Samantha sat on the front porch of the house. They consumed alcohol and smoked cigarettes. Deborah had between 5 and 10 glasses of wine. At about 10:30 p.m., Deborah passed out in her bed. Her sons fell asleep in the same bed as their mother. Presumably, Lisa was still in her crib in her own bedroom. The door to Lisa's bedroom was closed. Samantha remained on the front porch until about 11:30 p.m., talking to another neighbor. Jeremy arrived home at 3:30 a.m., now on October 4. This was much later than he had expected. Again, he thought he would be home by 10 p.m. Jeremy noticed a few things out of the ordinary around the house. The front door to the house was unlocked. Many of the lights in the house were activated. A window in the computer room was open, and the window screen was damaged, like it had been pushed in a little bit. What happened next is not known for certain. There are two different stories in media reports. One story indicates that Jeremy was unhappy with the lights being on because the family did not have a lot of money. In addition, he found a stray cat at the foot of the bed. Frustrated, Jeremy woke up Deborah. Once awake, Deborah realized that she had not checked on Lisa. She went into Lisa's bedroom and found the crib was empty. Another story states that Jeremy was the first to discover that Lisa was missing. Then he woke up Deborah. Either way, Lisa's parents were now aware that Lisa was not in her crib. Jeremy ran to Samantha Brando's house next door, but was told that Lisa was not there. In his house, Jeremy looked on the counter where the family had 3 cell phones. They had been deactivated due to non-payment. All 3 cell phones were missing. Jeremy ended up calling 911 on a cell phone that he used for work. Apparently, he always had this phone on his person. The police arrived quickly and searched the area, but did not have success locating Lisa. Here's what the police found during their investigation. A husband and wife reported seeing a man walking in the street at 12:50 a.m. on October 4. The man was carrying a baby who was only wearing a diaper. Considering it was about 45 degrees outside, they found this to be unusual. This sighting was just 3 houses away from the Irwin family home. A video surveillance camera at a gas station a mile from the Irwin family home captured a man walking out of the woods at 2:15 a.m. People in the area said that individuals usually did not walk out of these woods. A motorcycle rider who was on his way home from work at around 4 a.m. saw a man walking in the street. The man was holding a baby who was wearing only a diaper. This was 3 miles away from the Irwin family home. During the early morning hours, there was a fire in a dumpster a few blocks from the Irwin residence. There were baby's clothes in the dumpster. They were not the clothes that Lisa had on, but they may have belonged to her. The police were able to verify Jeremy's story about working late. They spoke to Deborah about what happened, but they were frustrated because Deborah kept changing her story. At first, she said that she only had a few glasses of wine. Then she kept increasing the amount until finally she admitted consuming between 5 and 10 glasses of wine. Deborah lied to the police saying that she checked on Lisa at 10:40 p.m., but then admitted that the last time she saw Lisa was at 6:40 p.m. The police gave Deborah a so-called lie detector test. They accused her of being involved in her daughter's disappearance. After this, Jeremy and Deborah stopped cooperating with the investigation. On October 17, a cadaver dog alerted to the scent of human remains near the bed of Lisa's parents. 2 days later, the FBI searched the Irwin family home. They seized a number of items, including a Cars-themed blanket, a multicolored Disney character shirt, a glowworm toy, rolls of tape, purple shorts, and a multicolored comforter. Even though investigators were highly interested in Jeremy and Deborah, they also looked at other potential suspects. The police became interested in the activities of a man named John Tanko, who went by the name Jersey, as in the state of New Jersey. He regularly used methamphetamine, liked to set fires, and frequently broke into houses, behaviors which undoubtedly made him feel as though he was honoring the legacy of his nickname. Witnesses placed John a block away from the Irwin family home on October 3 at 11:30 p.m. This was right around the time that Samantha Brando left the front porch and returned to her house. The 3 cell phones that were missing from the Irwin family home were used in the area throughout the night. It's not clear how this was possible if they were deactivated, but apparently they were used. At 11:57 p.m., one of the phones was used to call a woman named Megan Wright. She was the girlfriend of John Tanko. Jeremy and Deborah had never had any contact with Megan. This was the first time that her number was dialed from one of their phones. The relationship between John and Megan was in trouble. Megan wanted a child. Perhaps John took Lisa in order to accomplish this goal. The police arrested John on other warrants. He denied involvement in Lisa's disappearance. One of the witnesses who saw a man with a baby identified John as that man. The other witnesses said it was not John. The police have indicated that John is not a suspect. This seems like an unexpected declaration considering the evidence, but perhaps the police know something that they have not released to the public. Lisa Irwin has never been found. Her parents and investigators are still looking for her. Now moving to my analysis. Based on the behavior of law enforcement, it's clear they believe Lisa's parents could have been involved in Lisa's disappearance. Many people in the community where Lisa lived also believed Lisa's parents were somehow responsible. Jeremy and Deborah have repeatedly denied any involvement. Let's take a look at the evidence both for and against the idea that Lisa's parents were involved, starting with the inculpatory factors. On October 3, 2011, Deborah became intoxicated and passed out sometime around 10:30 p.m. She lied to the police about her alcohol consumption and about the last time she checked on her daughter, Lisa. Deborah told the police that after realizing that Lisa was missing, she did not check in the backyard because she was afraid of what she might see. This makes it seem as though Deborah knew something that she was not sharing with the police. Jeremy and Deborah stopped cooperating with the police. A cadaver dog alerted to the odor of a dead body right next to the bed in the master bedroom. Jeremy told the police about a window being open and a screen being pushed in, but investigators determined that no one entered the house through that window. It was too high off the ground, and there was still dirt on the windowsill. It is very unusual for a stranger to enter an occupied structure at night and kidnap an infant. From 1964 to 2019, 327 children under the age of one have been abducted in the United States. Only 140 of those were from private residences. Usually, kidnappers target children over the age of 12. 80% of stranger abductions involve victims between the ages of 12 and 18. Moving to the exculpatory factors, three witnesses saw a man carrying a baby around the time Lisa disappeared and not far from the Irwin family home. The theory that an intruder did not enter the window really doesn't matter considering the front door was unlocked. Jeremy and Deborah probably stopped cooperating with the police because the police accused Deborah of being involved in Lisa's disappearance. It appears as though the deceptive and heavy-handed tactics of the police backfired. As far as the cadaver dog alert, there is the sense that the Irwin family home was not going to win any clean house awards. For example, Deborah invited a stray cat into the house on October 3. Perhaps the dog was picking up on something other than a dead body. Jeremy's alibi was confirmed. He was telling the truth when he said that he was at work. He did not have enough time to do anything to Lisa. If Deborah passed out at 10:30 p.m., as she eventually stated, this means that she didn't have time either. If she was responsible, when did she carry out the offense? How did she manage to hide Lisa's body from everyone? Deborah could not have made it very far, and the police searched all around the house. In addition, she was intoxicated, not in the best condition for effectively hiding a body. The fire in the dumpster may have been connected to this case. It is unlikely that Deborah or Jeremy could have set that fire in the time available. Jeremy and Deborah did not have any motive to harm Lisa. Their relationship did not appear to be in trouble. For example, they stayed together after the disappearance. The three cell phones owned by the Irwin family were used in the area on the night of the disappearance. If Lisa's parents were responsible, how did they use those cell phones? Jeremy was working somewhere else, and Deborah was intoxicated at the house. When considering all the evidence, do I think that Lisa's parents were involved? No, I don't think they had anything to do with the disappearance. The timeline just doesn't work, and there is a plausible alternative theory of the crime. Here's what I think happened in this case. This is just a theory, my opinion. At some point, a male criminal offender took notice of the situation at the Irwin family home. He saw that a work vehicle was often parked there at night. During the evening of October 3, the man wandered into the area and noticed that the work vehicle was gone. He attempted to get in through the window, but gave up. Instead, he just walked right through the unlocked front door. The perpetrator grabbed the cell phones and took Lisa. Perhaps he was high on drugs, suffering from some mental health symptoms, or kidnapped Lisa for some awful purpose. The man may have burned some of the items he took from the house in the dumpster, although that fire could have been unrelated. Eventually, the man murdered Lisa. Deborah lied to the authorities because she knew that she was functionally incapacitated by alcohol when she should have been taking care of her daughter. Now moving to my final thoughts. After the disappearance, Deborah told the media she wished that she did not drink on the evening of October 3. I think it is reasonable to believe that the drinking led to the front door remaining unlocked. But if a stranger came into the house and took Lisa, this was an extremely low probability event that no one could have predicted. This disappearance is ranked among the 1 in a billion cases like Sabrina Eisenberg or Madeline McCann, where a perpetrator managed to take advantage of a defect in the physical security of where a victim was sleeping. Sometimes when perpetrators attempt offenses for which there is little motive, they catch people totally by surprise.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.